Ladies and gentlemen, we take you now by direct wire to the Shrine of the Little Flower, Royal Oak, Michigan, for the regular Sunday afternoon program of Father Charles E. Coughlin.
Ladies and gentlemen, Father Coughlin is deeply grateful to the thousands of persons who proved their interest in last Sunday's broadcast by writing to him for copies. This series of broadcasts, opened last Sunday, will continue for the next 7 or 8 Sundays. Each lecture will contain information of a vital nature, information related to the greatest national problems which beset us, the problems of prosperity and peace. Supplementing these lectures, the editors of Social Justice Magazine, under the supervision of Father Coughlin, will begin reproducing and printing information found only in government documents. Information related to unemployment, debt, war, peace, and finance. These are days when all thoughtful citizens should be armed with such information, for only the truth will make you free. Thus, here is an opportunity for you. Please address a letter this week to Father Coughlin, asking him to put your name on the mailing list for these few weeks at least, so that you will receive this first-hand, vital, factual information. Simply address your letter to him at Royal Oak, Michigan. To dispel idle rumors which are gaining some currency, this broadcast is in no wise donated. It is fully paid for at full commercial rates. Its cost is assimilated by the friends of Father Coughlin in this radio audience and by those who appreciate the information which he incorporates in his lectures. In these days when truth is so precious, it is most heartening to know that your reverend speaker is encouraged by the magnificent support which his unprejudiced listeners are extending to him. Every workday for the past several weeks, Father Coughlin's office is answering approximately 20,000 letters. 20,000 requests for copies of the literature which he is distributing. Write this week for your copy. You cannot afford to deprive yourself of reading at your leisure the contents of today's lecture. And now, ladies and gentlemen, Father Coughlin.
Ladies and gentlemen and friends, in a spirit of cooperation rather than of criticism, I approach the discussion of one phase of our financial system. In doing so, let it be clear that I am neither impugning any man nor questioning any motive. I am trying to make a contribution of facts which will enable all in this audience to weigh our de facto financial system, which, to my mind, is not only obsolete insofar as it is unable to meet the present needs of modern society, but which, if sustained in its present activities, will, in my opinion, produce untold misery in this land teeming with wealth. After all, our present financial system is a human invention. Like all products of the human mind, it can be perfected. Thus to the point. Last Sunday, I brought to your attention a release made public by our Treasury Department, in which was stated that our federal debt, or obligations represented in bonds, amounts to $45.4 billion as of June 30th, 1939. Now, of this vast amount, the commercial and savings banks of the nation hold $18.8 billion. In all, not counting what private individuals or non-financial corporations own, there are approximately $30 billion of these bonds held in banks, insurance companies, and other financial and quasi-financial corporations. That is a tremendous amount of money. Our question is, how did the banks and financial institutions in the first place acquire this money? To answer this question, one is constrained to inquire, how did these bonds come into existence? And what is their nature? Before engaging your attention with the discussion of the above questions, it is necessary to review some facts pertinent to the Federal Reserve Banks. On December 23, 1913, 27 years ago, a Federal Reserve Act was approved by the Congress of the United States. This act permitted bankers to establish a banker's bank, or to be more precise, 12 banker's banks, situated one in each regional division of the United States of America. During the course of years, the original Federal Reserve Act was amended or perfected. For example, on June 1, 1933, the amended Federal Reserve Act, according to government documents, was passed, quote, to provide for the establishment of Federal Reserve banks to furnish an elastic currency, unquote, and for other purposes. According to law, quotations, every national banking association shall be required within 30 days to subscribe to the capital stock of such Federal Reserve banks in a sum equal to 6% of the paid-up capital stock and surplus of such bank. Now, in other words, your local bank, belonging to the Federal Reserve System, and there are very few banks in the United States not belonging to it, your local bank is a part owner of the Federal Reserve Banking System. The entire Federal Reserve Banking System is owned by the local banks, which in turn are owned by the stockholders, who are, generally speaking, men and women living in your own community. To quote the Federal Reserve Act again, we read on page 3 of the Act, quotations, the shareholders of every Federal Reserve Bank shall be held individually responsible for all contracts, debts, and engagements of such banks to the extent of the amount of their subscription to the stock of the Federal Reserve Bank. In other words, the Federal Reserve Banking System is a privately owned corporation. It is not a government-owned corporation, as some persons believe. As factual as is the statement that the Federal Reserve Banks are privately owned corporations, not government-owned corporations, it is both amusing and alarming to learn that not only some factory workers, but also some professional men and businessmen labor under the impression that the Federal Reserve Banking System is a government-owned corporation. In the official hearings previous to the passage of the Banking Act of 1935, we read on page 304 of this government document the following classic conversation, which took place between the late Senator James Cousins of Michigan, Mariner Eccles, the governor of the Federal Reserve Board, not the governor of the Federal Reserve Banks, by the way, and Senator Townsend. Here is the conversation. Senator Cousins, have you ever heard of the criticism that exists among the ordinary depositors of the fact that they felt that when they saw Federal on those windows, that they felt that they were guaranteed and taken care of by the federal government? Governor Eccles, I haven't heard that. Senator Cousins, never heard that? Governor Eccles, no. Senator Cousins, I've had a number of letters to that effect. Senator Townsend, you have heard of criticism of the name of banks? For example, the United States Bank? Governor Eccles, yes, I have. I've heard that criticism, but never of the Federal Reserve System. Senator Townsend, Well, there were a number of Federal Reserve systems. Governor Eccles. Yes, but I've not heard of cases where people felt simply because a bank was a member of the Federal Reserve System that it was a government-owned bank. I've heard of cases where people thought that a First National Bank was government-owned, but those cases, I think, are quite remote. Unquote conversation. Governor Eccles of the Federal Reserve Board was very innocent, or else overestimated the knowledge of the American public. As a matter of fact, many persons at that time believed that the Federal Reserve banks were owned by the government. There are three more points relative to the Federal Reserve banks that may prove to be interesting before I transfer your attention to the subject of bonds. The first point answers the question, who makes the profits from the operations of the Federal Reserve banks? Page 14 of the Federal Reserve Act answers that question. Here it is. After all necessary expenses of a Federal Reserve Bank shall have been paid or provided for, the stockholders shall be entitled to receive an annual dividend of 6% on the paid-in capital stock, which dividend shall be cumulative. After the aforesaid dividend claims have been fully met, the net earnings shall be paid into the surplus fund of the Federal Reserve Bank. The net earnings derived by the United States from the Federal Reserve Bank shall, in the discretion of the Secretary, be used to supplement the gold reserve held against outstanding United States notes, or shall be applied to the reduction of the outstanding bonded indebtedness of the United States under regulations to be prescribed by the Secretary of the Treasury. Unquote. Next Sunday, this point will be clarified. The second point is this. Federal Reserve banks, including the capital stock and surplus therein, and the income derived therefrom, shall be exempt from federal, state, and local taxation, except taxes upon real estate. I've just quoted from the Act. In other words, this privately owned corporation, gigantic in size and in operation, is tax exempt except for real estate purposes. The third point relative to the Federal Reserve Board, not bank, but board. According to the Federal Reserve Act, a governing board is created consisting of 8 members, including the Secretary of the Treasury and the Comptroller of the Currency, and 6 private citizens appointed by the President of the United States by and with the advice and consent of the Senate. These 8 persons are the government watchdogs, as it were, whose business it is to see that the Federal Reserve banks operate legally. The salaries and expenses of 6 of the members of the board are paid by the Federal Reserve Bank. The Federal Reserve Board, as far as ownership is concerned, enjoys the same relation to the Federal Reserve Bank as does the Federal Communication Commission, for example, to the privately owned radio stations and telegraph corporations like Western Union and Postal. This Federal Reserve Board has been in existence since the Federal Reserve Banks were established in 1913. It was in existence during the Panic of 1920 and failed to avert it, although every person knew it was a financial panic. It was in existence in 1929 and failed to avert this depression, which was notorious, among other causes, for its unreasonable debt inflation. Still withal, there are many honest men who adopt the viewpoint that our present financial system is sound as long as the Federal Reserve Board, vested with definite powers, is the watchdog of the Federal Reserve Banks. 12 privately owned corporations, which, as I will show in the course of these several lectures, create the vast bulk of the money we use at a profit for themselves, put it into the stream of business or withdraw it therefrom, pay no taxes except those on real estate to the government, although practically speaking, they enjoy the monopoly of money creation and, in one sense, run little risk of loss insofar as the government guarantees deposits in local banks up to a given sum. Now, with this skeleton background of the Federal Reserve Banks in our minds, let us proceed to the subject of the billions upon billions of dollars worth of bonds which the banks, who are members and owners of the Federal Reserve, hold in their vault. First of all, a government bond is a promise made by the government to pay the bondholder the principal sum plus the interest in lawful money represented by the bond. Promise to pay. It means that for every Federal Reserve bond extant, the taxpayers of the nation must surrender part of their wages or earnings to redeem that bond, which, after all, is a mortgage upon their pay envelopes, their houses, their factories, their farms, and their merchandise, and in one sense, a mortgage upon their jobs. Federal bonds are federal debts, which all citizens must share. Debts to be liquidated either through direct taxation or through consumers' taxation, in payment of which every person must share. In other words, the $30 billion worth of bonds held by the financial institutions, the banks also that belong to the Federal Reserve and own it, really is not $30 billion wealth dollars. Do not forget that a minus sign should be placed in front of that $30 billion to describe it correctly. At this juncture, let me quote from page 306 of the Banking Act of 1935, a public document. Senator Townsend is questioning Governor Echols of the Federal Reserve Board. The senator says, Senator Townsend, well, as a matter of fact, the bonds that we issue is inflation, is it not? Governor Echols, to the extent that they create a deficit, unquote, quote, conversation. Now, in other words, that's the minus sign to which I refer, the deficit. Governor Echols continues to state that when bonds are issued by the government, the banks create the money. He says, quotation, a deficit financed by government bond issues of $4 billion will add, if these bonds are taken by the banking system, $4 billion of deposits to the banking system, unquote, Governor Echols. In other words, my friends, every time the government borrows from the banks, and do not think that I am misspeaking myself when I say this, every time the government borrows from the banks, money is added to the deposits of the banks. Borrow $4 billion, and the deposits of the banks increase $4 billion. Borrow $30 billion, and the deposits of the banks increase $30 billion. How are these billions of minus dollars put into circulation? Mr. Echols, and if any man in all the world should know what he is talking about, it should be Mr. Echols, the governor of the Federal Reserve Board. Mr. Echols says, quotation, the deposits will first go to the government. The government spends the funds. They come to the banks as deposits of individuals and corporations, unquote. Now, for the important question. Where did the banks get the money to buy the bonds from the government? If you and I, private citizens, buy a government $1,000 bond, we pay $1,000 of money that we earned by our labor or enterprise. But not so with the banks. Only simple, uninformed persons think that the banks pay dollar for the bonds they receive from the government. To prove that, well, here's what Mr. Eccles says on page 308. Says he, to the extent that the public buys a government bond, it in no way changes the volume of money. It in no way changes the volume of money in the system when the individuals and corporations buy the bonds. But when the banks buy bonds, it does make a difference. To the extent that the deposits are increased by the banks purchasing bonds, the excess reserves of the banks are reduced by, only is my own word, are reduced by 10%. In other words, if the banks buy $1 billion of government bonds, I'm still quoting Mr. Eccles, the deposits of the banks, as a rule, are increased by $1 billion. And the average required reserve is increased by $100 million. Therefore, if the banks have $1 billion excess reserve and then buy $1 billion worth of government bonds, and increase the deposits $1 billion, their own deposits, their excess reserve is reduced to $900 million. In other words, unquote Mr. Eccles, in other words, according to the figures of Mr. Eccles, the man who should know, the Federal Reserve Bank members pay no more than $100 for a $1,000 bond, $100,000 for a $1 million bond. For the $18,900,000,000 worth of bonds now held by the banks, they paid, according to these figures, only $1,189,000,000. Now, let us pause to review what was said. I shall put it in question and answer form. What are the steps taken when the banks get government bonds for nothing? Yes, for nothing, except the cost of making bookkeeping entries and the reduction of their excess reserves equaling one-tenth the value of their bond. Here are the steps. First, well, there's need to build battleships or feed the hungry or engage in some government project that will cost, let's say, $1 million. Congress approves the project. Congress appropriates the money. Congress instructs the Treasury to borrow it from the banks. Next, the Secretary of the Treasury then instructs the Bureau of Engraving to manufacture or print United States bonds. Next, these United States bonds, which are a first mortgage on every home, farm, business, income, and job, are allocated to the local banks throughout the country. Each bank, that is, member of the Federal Reserve, each bank indicates how many bonds it wants. It will always ask for more than it hopes to get. Why not? This is something for nothing proposition, affecting the excess reserves of the bank only to the extent that its reserves are depleted one-tenth of the value of the bond. Next, when the bonds are received by the banker, he makes a bookkeeping entry, marking down as assets $1 million of bonds, and as liabilities, $1 million of deposits. Next, then Uncle Sam obtains a check for $1 million, which the banker obtained by having decreased his reserves only by $100,000. On this point, Governor Eccles says, quotation, in purchasing offerings of government bonds, the banking system as a whole creates new money or bank deposits. When the banks buy $1 billion of government bonds as they are offered, and you have to consider the banking system as a whole, as a unit, the banks credit the deposit account of the Treasury with $1 billion. And they debit their government bond accounts
$1 billion. Or they actually create, by a bookkeeping entry, $1 billion, unquote Governor Eccles. That quotation is found in hearings before a subcommittee of the Committee on Banking and Currency, United States Senate, Senate Document 1715, and House of Representatives, House of Representatives 5357, page 399, 74th Congress, First Section, Banking Act of 1935. Now, Mr. Eccles says again, when I say credit in this connection, I mean money. Because by far the largest part of money in use by the people of this country is in the form of bank credit or bank deposits. That statement is found on page 181 of the Banking Act of 1935. And again, he says, money is created in our present system by banks loaning to corporations, to individuals, and to the government. Unquote, Mr. Eccles. That statement found on page 399 of the Banking Act of 1935. My friend, the statements which I have made are almost unbelievable. It is unbelievable that privately owned banks, who own the Federal Reserve Bank, create money through the process of bonds and loans. It is unbelievable that 95% of our business and money is conducted through the money that these banks create. It is unbelievable that at 3% interest, we pay these privately owned banks for creating money $900 million a year on the $30 billion of bonds that they hold. It is unbelievable that the local banks, the members of the Federal Reserve Bank, are engaged not so much in lending money to small business, to small homeowners, to farmers on any large scale, as they are engaged in buying the debt of the nation. It is unbelievable that the members of the Federal Reserve Banks collect interest on at least 9/10 of the bonds which they secured without even buying them with a penny of legal tender. It is unbelievable that the more debt the government creates and the more bonds the local banks obtain, the greater is the profit for the bankers under this present system. Oh, it's a system, to my mind, that thrives on misery. I said that 95% of our business is conducted with the money created by the bankers as a result of their getting bonds from the government with $100 for a $1,000 bond. And speaking of things that are unbelievable, the Federal Reserve Board, not the Federal Reserve Bank, the Federal Reserve Board, the government watchdog, is empowered to require the Federal Reserve Banks, directly and indirectly the local banks, to purchase or sell government bonds without any limitation. That's found on page 310 of the hearings of the Senate on the Banking Act of 1935. Now, this means, in my opinion, that if the financial policies now in vogue will be continued for another 3 or 6 years, necessitating more borrowing, more bonds, the vaults in the local banks will hold not $30 billion of bonds, but $60 billion. The national debt will not be $45 billion, but $90 billion. And the tax burden which the citizens are bearing will be double what they are today. Now, in concluding this portion of my lecture, I see several weaknesses in our present financial structure. And I warn you that these are my opinions based on the facts which I've just cited. Opinions which I readily admit are not shared by many economists, not sociologists. Well, first, this is a structure predicated upon debt, not upon wealth. Second, it's a structure owned not by the government and the people, but by private corporations, who in one sense are subject to the control of the Federal Reserve Board, and in another sense are not. And thirdly, it's a structure which, as a result of this control, forces private banks to buy government debts, government bonds, to invest in debt rather than invest in the enterprises of a local community, although your local bank got its start from the money obtained from the local community. I just said that the Federal Reserve banks are owned by private corporations and are governed in one sense by a federal control board, and in another sense are not governed by a federal control board. Now, to clarify this statement, let me use the words of the comptroller of the currency, Mr. J.F.T. O'Connor, who in a letter written to Mr. Owen D. Young on June 6, 1935, said, quotations, Federal Reserve banks are owned by member banks. Well, the controller of the currency joins with the governor of the Federal Reserve Board in stating that the Federal Reserve banks are owned by member banks. Six of the directors of such banks are elected by member banks, private interests, and should the present Title II of the Banking Act of 1935 be enacted, the entire supervision would be in the hands of the governor of the Federal Reserve Bank, not the governor of the Federal Reserve Board, who would be elected by the directors. You would then have the situation of the very men, in some cases, whose banks are to be examined, sitting on a board of directors of an institution charged with the responsibility of examination of the particular institutions these men represent. It would certainly seem to be against the public policy for a man to appoint an examiner to examine his own bank. It is difficult, continues Mr. O'Connor, to see how Federal Reserve banks can take the responsibility of supervision when, as is frequently the case, they are the member bank's largest creditor. How can a Federal Reserve Bank deal impartially with depositors in insolvent banks in the hands of receivers if it is responsible for the appointment of the receiver and must also collect its own debt against the bank? Unquote Mr. O'Connor. He's only the comptroller of the currency in 1935. Now, that letter, ladies and gentlemen, that I read, will be found on page 1004 of a book entitled Hearings on the Senate Bill 1715 and the House of Representatives Bill 7617 on the Banking Act of 1935. I have a copy of the letter in the document. Possibly the best yardstick to use in measuring the efficiency of the present financial system is the one which is related to the statement, by their fruits they shall be known. Now, what are the fruits of the present financial system? In the last 7 years, our government has spent in cash over $26 billion to create jobs and raise the purchasing power of the people. In the same period of time, 7 years, it spent $6 billion for materials to be used essentially in a works program. In the same period of time, it has loaned $17 billion to business to create jobs for the unemployed. Now, that makes $49 billion in 7 years, which our government has put into the channels of commerce and trade, primarily to give employment to those who sought a job in our country. Still withal, we are told that approximately 10 million persons who are seeking jobs cannot find them. We are told that two-thirds of our families are still living on an annual income of $69 a month. Last Sunday, I explained that. We are told that more than 40,000 farms have been confiscated by government. Not by banks so much, but by government. As well as hundreds of thousands of homes and properties. We're told that taxation has risen abnormally. And we're told, this is a sad thing, that production is practically up to normal. In other words, $49 billion. Those are some of the fruits. Debt money has failed to filter down adequately and efficiently to the farmer, the laborer, and the unemployed. Yes, production is almost up to normal. And fewer men, both laborers and farmers, are being used in production. That's the sad part of it. But distribution, in other words, is absolutely out of gear. Production up, but no distribution. That is efficient. Now, is it not true that when I mention the word distribution, we understand the movement of foodstuffs from the farm through the store to your pantry? That we understand the movement of wearing apparel from the cotton fields or the sheepfold through the mill to your clothes closet? Or shelter from the forest, the quarries, the mines, through the factories, to a roof over your head that you can call your own? That's what we mean by distribution. Why haven't two-thirds of our population the food, the clothing, and the shelter they require? It's all here in America in the raw. It's all here in our wonderful factories and in our skilled men. It is not distributed. Because the financial system, which is the medium of distribution, has broken down. Instead of being a help to the majority of our citizens, has not our financial system, the one that I have partially described, has it not been more or less of a detriment? According to the congressional record of March 20, 1940, Mr. Eccles, the governor of the Federal Reserve Board, not the governor of the Federal Reserve Bank, I repeat, is reported to have said that we can have a debt of $100 billion. Does the governor mean that we can have $100 billion debt with the present prices, the present unemployment, the present rate of taxation, and the present discontent? Does the governor mean that only persons who will prosper in this nation under such a system will be the owners of the debt? And these chiefly are the owners of the private banks, which in turn own the Federal Reserve banking system? Private banks that buy our debt at $100 for $1,000 worth? My friends, I have heard it said in financial circles of late that our national debt is money which we owe to ourselves. I have heard the question argued, why should we pay ourselves what we owe ourselves? I have heard the conclusion drawn that neither the government nor the owners of the Federal Reserve System care very much whether or not we pay the principal as long as we pay the interest. Their interest, pyramided from $30 billion to $90 billion, that would mean a lot. men who defend such a theory simply want to wax fat on the $1, $2, or $3 billion of interest money which we citizens and taxpayers will be required to expend for the privilege of supporting a system of debt money, of fountain pen money, which is issued into circulation with an interest charge upon it by a privately owned corporation that is governmentally controlled, we admit. Yes, by their fruits they shall be known is not a bad yardstick to employ in judging the efficiency and the efficacy of the present financial system, which is notorious for pyramiding debts and for failing to contribute very much towards the solution of our unemployment problem, towards the solution of an annual living wage, towards the solution of production at a profit for the farmer, towards the solution of multiplying the ownership of private homes, towards the solution of discontent, towards the solution of decentralizing wealth now concentrated in the hands of a few. Now, that last point, the concentration of wealth in the hands of a few, that is part and parcel of the Federal Reserve banking system. For to my mind, be it known that the local banks, that is the member banks of the Federal Reserve system, not only create money when they accept Federal Reserve bonds by making loans to the government. Oh, indeed. They also create money when they make a loan to a private citizen. How is that, you ask? Well, in the case of a private citizen, yourself, for example, if you wish to borrow $10,000 from a bank, the bank obliges you, in most cases, to put up security, namely your home or your factory or your farm. The bank then loans you $10,000, having marked on its books a $10,000 deposit. But the loan which it makes to you is only a checkbook. It doesn't loan you $10,000 actual dollars. It creates at least 9/10 of that $10,000 by a stroke of the pen. You get a checkbook granting you the privilege of writing $10,000 worth of checks. If you fail, when overcome by ill health or by a depression, to make your payments to the bank, what happens? Your home, your farm or your factory is seized. In the first instance, you were loaned only privately created money, more properly called debt money with a minus sign in front of it, money that does not actually exist. And in the last instance, when you fail to meet the payment of the debt represented by fountain pen money, what happens? Your real wealth is confiscated. You lose your home or your factory or your farm. Now, I'm not impugning the men who own or who are engaged in the local banks or in the Federal Reserve banking system. I'm simply calling to your attention the unworkability of the present financial system, which to my mind is predicated upon debt. The more debt, the more prosperous it is. And which, to my mind, is leading this country into chaos. And incidentally, vested with this tremendous power of creating money through the medium of loans, the Federal Reserve banks and their affiliates, namely the local banks, and the Federal Reserve Board might possibly repeat in 1940 the history chronicled in 1914, 15, 16, and 17. Yes, the Federal Reserve banks were in existence then. So was the Federal Reserve Board. Now, relative to that history, back in 1914, 15, 16, and 17, let me conclude this lecture by reading to you document number 763, period, 72111-35½A, which the Secretary of the Treasury of State, William Jennings Bryan at the time, addressed to President Wilson on August 10, 1914. Here's what the Secretary of State said to the President of the United States in an official document, which I have. My dear Mr. President, I beg to communicate to you an important matter which has come before the department. Morgan Company of New York have asked whether there would be any objection to their making a loan to the French government and also the Rothschilds. I suppose that is intended for the French government. I have conferred with Mr. Lansing, later on the Secretary of State, and he knows of no legal objection to financing this loan. But I have suggested to him the advisability of presenting to you an aspect of the case which is not legal, but I believe to be consistent with our attitude in international matters. It is whether it would be advisable for this government to take the position that it will not approve of any loan to a belligerent nation. The reasons that I would give in support of this proposition are, first, money. Money is the worst of all contrabands because it commands everything else. The question of making loans contraband by international agreement has been discussed, but no action has been taken. I know of nothing that would do more to prevent war than an international agreement that neutral nations would not loan to belligerents. While such an agreement would be of great advantage, could we not, by our example, hasten the reaching of such an agreement? We are the one great nation which is not involved, and our refusal to loan to any belligerent would naturally tend to hasten the conclusion of the war. We are responsible for the use of our influence through example, and as we cannot tell what we can do until we try, the only way of testing our influence is to set the example and observe its effect. This is the fundamental reason in support of the suggestion submitted. Second, still quoting the famous letter, there is a special and local reason, it seems to me, why this course would be advisable. Mr. Lansing observed in the discussion of the subject that a loan would be taken by those in sympathy with the country in whose behalf the loan was negotiated. If we approved of a loan to France, we could not, of course, object to a loan to Great Britain, Germany, Russia, Austria, or to any other country. And if loans were made to these countries, our citizens would be divided into groups, each group loaning money to the country which it favors, and this money could not be furnished without expressions of sympathy. These expressions of sympathy are disturbing enough when they do not rest upon pecuniary interests. They would be still more disturbing if each group was pecuniarily interested in the success of the nation to whom its members had loaned money. Third, still quoting Mr. William Jennings Bryan, the powerful financial interests which would be connected with these loans would be tempted to use their influence through the newspapers to support the interests of the government to which they had loaned because the value of the security would be directly affected by the result of the war. We would thus find our newspapers violently arrayed on one side or the other, each paper supporting a financial group and a pecuniary interest. All of this influence would make it all the more difficult for us to maintain neutrality, as our action on various questions that would arise would affect one side or the other, and powerful financial interests would be thrown into the balance. I am to talk over the telephone with Mr. Davidson of the Morgan Company at 1 o'clock, but I will have him delay final action until you have time to consider this question. It grieves me to be compelled to intrude any question upon you at this time, but I'm sure you will pardon me for submitting a matter of such great importance with assurances, etc., W.J. Bryan. Postscript. Postscript. This is important, too. Mr. Lansing calls attention to the fact that an American citizen who goes abroad and voluntarily enlists in the army of a belligerent nation loses the protection of his citizenship while so engaged. And he asks, why dollars going abroad and enlisting in war should be more protected? As we cannot prevent American citizens going abroad at their own risk, so we cannot prevent dollars going abroad at the risk of the owners. But the influence of the government is used to prevent American citizens from doing this. Would the government not be justified in using its influence against the enlistment of the nation's dollars in foreign wars? The Morgans say that the money would be spent here, but the floating of these loans would absorb the loanable funds and might affect our ability to borrow. That's the end of the famous letter. Before I proceed, I might say that following this letter, there are at least 40 more pages in this wonderful document which I possess, telling how from this innocent start, a request made by Morgan and Company to lend money and float bonds for the belligerents of the World War finally won out and finally got us into the war. Some of these documents I shall print in Social Justice newspaper next week. My friend, I recognize I have not been constructive in today's lecture. In the pages of Social Justice magazine, and next Sunday at the same hour, over these same stations, I hope to pursue this subject, tell you more about our financial system. But I leave this thought with you, namely, is it not possible to issue money against the wealth of the nation? Is it not possible for Congress, through its own agency, to issue tax-exempt money? Did I not say previously that $18.9 billion worth of the bonds the banks now have were obtained with $1.89 billion? 10 cents on the dollar was their purchase price. Well, is it not possible to solve the problem of distribution just as well as we have solved the problem of production? Is it not possible for Americans living in this land of plenty to enjoy the products thereof instead of being barred from enjoying them because, to my mind, we are wedded to an obsolete system of finance? Well, trusting that these thoughts which I have expressed will prove of interest to all of you, I shall consider it a favor if you will permit me to mail you a copy of this address which is only one of a series. And if you will also permit me to enroll your name on the mailing list of social justice for points relative to the Federal Reserve Act, to the Banking Act of 1933, to the Banking Act of 1935, and to the whole financial structure will be published, supported by documentary evidence of an official nature. My friends, I thank you for listening to this rather abstract lecture, and I ask you, if it is not inconvenient, to listen in again next Sunday at the same hour when this subject will be discussed further.
Ladies and gentlemen, possibly there are some facts contained in the lecture to which you have just listened which you did not know. Undoubtedly, the facts and figures which Father Coughlin has marshaled in the last two Sundays' lectures and which he has prepared for the following six or seven Sundays will prove to be most interesting and educational to hundreds of thousands in this audience. It is my privilege to invite you to write to Father Coughlin this week asking him to mail you a copy of these lectures which he will print in book form. There is no charge for the book. However, to enable Father Coughlin to order the proper number of copies, please mail your requests as soon as it is convenient. Again, on behalf of Father Coughlin, I thank you most sincerely for the support which has made this broadcast possible. I thank you for the gracious letters which you have poured upon the Reverend Speaker's desk at a time when your confidence is most deeply appreciated. And now, in the remaining few moments of our broadcast, we ask you to join with us in listening to the Little Flower Choristers, transcribed at New York under the direction of Emil Côté, as they sing for us, O Sacred Heart, O Love Divine. Now, ladies and gentlemen, in closing, may we ask you once again to be prompt in mailing your requests for the printed book of lectures which Father Coghlan will be happy to mail to you. And once again to join us at next Sunday at this same time.
We have presented the regular Sunday afternoon program of Father Charles E. Coghlan from Royal Oak, Michigan.